Hi, this is Esty, host of the Friday A Public Affair. I hope you help us by contributing to WORT, and you can also subscribe to the podcast. Bye.
6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before.
No change without struggle. No one in power ain't giving up nothing. No change without struggle. No one in power.
WORT 89.9 FM, listener-sponsored community radio, Madison, Wisconsin. And hello, welcome to A Public Affair. I am Esty Dinor, and this is the last Friday in the pledge drive, and we are looking today to get your pledges. Again, I have a big goal. I need you to help me. Let me tell you who we're going to have now, and then I'll tell you quickly what the premia are, and then we're going to start. So our guest today is Professor Richard Wolff, and we'll be talking about his latest book, The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. So just by that, I think, you know, we've had Richard Wolff on the show before, and also the title of the book, I think, tells you something about what we'll be talking about. And if you want to help Richard and I do our best to dismantle capitalism and come up with something better, it's your opportunity today, because as you know, on this station, we talk a lot about both the ills of capitalism and how to come up with better things. We talk a lot about the people who are suffering because of capitalism, and again, what we can do to come up with a better system. So the number here is 608-256-2001. You want to press extension 1 today. And you can also pledge online at wortfm.org, or you can just go there and, it used to be that if you go there, you have to pay right away. This time you can just pledge and we will send you our thing, our note, our whatever it is, our letter, and ask you to pay. We also need at least one new monthly pledger, someone who will pay at least $5 every month right out of their bank account. And it would be absolutely lovely to have another person or two who increase their monthly pledge. So 608-256-2001, extension 1, wortfm.org. Again, you know what to expect. You've heard Richard Wolff before, so you can start pledging right now. And we do, in fact, have a pledge already, Harry Richardson. Thank you so much for pledging again. And he says, keep up the good work and Esty's good guests and issues covered. Yay, Harry. Thank you so much. I would love many of you to follow up in his footsteps. Let me tell you really quickly what you can get, though we know it, you don't pledge for the premium, but you can get some. So at the 25 level, there's a new Wort bumper sticker. It's very lovely and colorful and so on. At the 45 level, you can get Madison, the Illustrated History, 1856 to 1931 by Stu Levitan, or 1 year Progressive Magazine subscription, which is that's a good one. At the 60 level, new Wort mask with a breakaway lanyard. It has a small Wort logo. another good one. At the 100 level, new wart long sleeve t-shirt. I love these t-shirts. At $100, you can get that. And at the 180 level, you can get wart imprinted House of Marley headphones. And they will be 160 for new or current wart monthly donors only. So you can also pledge at any other level. You don't have to ask for a premium if you don't want to. Do ask for one if you want to. I'd love to get many pledges right away so I don't have to stop too many times and for too long. To pledge up. I'd rather listen to Richard Wolff. So, Richard D. Wolff is Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's currently a visiting professor in the graduate program in International Affairs of the New School University in New York City. He is the founder of Democracy at Work and host of the nationally syndicated show Economic Update. His latest book that we'll be talking about is The Sickness is the System: When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. It can be found along with his other books, Understanding Socialism and Understanding Marxism, at democracyatwork.info. Richard, thank you so very much for joining us again and for sitting patiently through this pledge wrap. Hopefully we won't have to pledge wrap anymore this hour, but who knows. What do you mean by the title of the book?
Well, you know, I was reacting, Esty, to all of the headlines about the sickness we face, the crisis of a pandemic, and all of that that you all know very well. We've all been living through it together. And I wanted to take advantage of the focus on the concept of a disease or a virus or a sickness, but to change the focus, to focus us more on the disease we don't talk about, the sickness we don't admit we even have, as the one we ought to be talking about, because it was here before the pandemic arrived. And it will be with us after the pandemic is over, assuming that that's in our future. And that even the pandemic itself has been profoundly shaped by the sickness I'm talking about, and that is our capitalist system. I mean, let me start with that a little bit, if I may.
Yeah, please. That's, I think, very important.
Yes. I mean, look at some of the most basic statistics. They are so profound, so arresting, so stark that they, in a way, tell the story even before I tell it. So here it is. The United States has 4.5% of the world's people. That is the population of the United States, roughly 330 million people. Is 4.5% of the people who populate this planet. Okay, but when it comes to counting people who have died from COVID, the United States has 20%. Now, let me make sure everybody understands this. We are one of the richest countries in the world. We have one of the most highly developed medical systems in the world, and our inability to prepare for or to cope with this pandemic is a disaster of proportions I can hardly underscore. The only other time in American history that we were confronted with a pandemic on this scale was back in 1918. That's a little over 100 years ago. And we have already passed, now as I'm speaking, the number of people who died back then, which was about 665,000 people or so. And we, this last week, we crossed that number. So we are now the worst. I mean, back in 1918, we were not the richest country in the world, not close. We did not have a highly developed medical system. The last century has seen the United States become vastly wealthy, wealthier and vastly more developed in all of its technologies. And yet we have done worse against this disease than we did a century ago. And here's one more way to drive it home. We are supposedly in a contest, or to use our president's term, a competition with the People's Republic of China. Well, if there was a competition on dealing with COVID, then the results of that competition are in. They won, we lost. China has over four times the population of the United States. Roughly 1.4 billion people live in China compared to 330 million here. And how many people have died of COVID in China? Roughly 6,000. That's 1% of the number of people who died here. The United States has lost 99 for every one person lost in China.
Really?
And China is not the richest country in the world. It's not even close. It is still a relatively poor country. It has been growing dramatically. It's far less poor than it was 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago. But it's no match for the United States in terms of wealth, technology, income, or anything else. Yet, they were able to mobilize public and private resources to defeat that disease. Let me drive it again. 6,000 people in China have died from COVID. 675,000 people have died from COVID in this country. That is a failure of the system. You cannot blame that on this or that doctor, this or that pharmaceutical company. Not that there isn't blame and problems in all those areas, but this is way too big a problem to be blamed on an individual or a group of individuals. This is what we mean when we use the phrase systemic failure.
Mm-hmm.
And I could go on, but let's start with this question of the sickness, because if, for example, you want to deal with the sickness that threatens us most, it's not the virus. It's a capitalism that no longer solves the most basic problems any human community demands of its economic system. One of those basic demands, keep us healthy. Protect public health. It's like providing food, clothing, and shelter. That's how you measure throughout human history how effective an economic system has been. And when it can't do it, and our capitalism is no longer able to do it, that's the time when people have every right and every obligation to say, as you did in introducing today's program, that capitalism itself is something we ought to be debating. Its strengths, its weaknesses, in order to see whether we can't do, as I'm convinced we can, better than capitalism.
And folks, you can see that you are going to get some deep conversation here today. I would like to not have to pledge up. For that, I will need to hear from you, from all of the anti-capitalists among you and the others too. If you just want to think about it, you can still pledge to us 608-256-2001 extension 1 or wartfm.org, where you don't, I mean, you can listen and work on the computer as you do all the time anyway. I will have to stop and pledge up if I don't hear from you. I haven't gotten another pledge yet since Harry. So please hurry. And we have Sandy who donated online. Thank you very much, Sandy. And I'm going to go straight back to Professor Wolf, to Professor Richard Wolf. and trust you to pledge for us. Otherwise, I will have to stop and pledge up. So, Richard, let me kind of bundle two points or two questions in one. One is that this is not the first time. I remember, for example, what happened in New Orleans when all these people had to go to the Metrodome and there were long lines of cars. People weren't able to get out of there. My own family has been dealing with fires in Northern California. And it just boggles my mind every time that people have to escape themselves, where in places like Bangladesh, there's a flood. The government makes sure to get people out of the flood zone and to have places for them to rest and eat and be warm and be dry and so on and so forth. So it just seems like this country is never mind who is the president, never mind who the administration is, it's just never ready for disasters, be they person-made or nature-made. And so that really shows, I think, that the whole system is rotten, that we're never, in this country, we're never ready for anything except to bail out the banks, for example. And the second question, I already kind of alluded to it, is does it matter who's in the White House? Does it matter whether it is the Republicans? I mean, clearly, under Trump, 600,000 people died. Under Biden, fewer. But would we have been better prepared if Biden was the president at the time that the pandemic hit? So there you go. People, right. Pledge, please.
Let me respond in a few ways. First of all, you know, I think it's very, very important what you just said. It is the role of the government to take care of all the people. It is our representative. We are supposed to have a government that serves the people, and nothing is more urgent to serve the people than to keep them alive, to keep them away from drowning, to keep them away from burning up, to keep them away from a deadly virus. I mean, it doesn't take a genius to understand that before you can do a lot of other things for human beings, you have to provide them with the basics. Now, either the government does it or the government works with somebody else, some other institution to do it. Here in the United States, the government works with the private capitalist economic system, the business community, and the employees that work for the business community. And one of the lame defenses for capitalism's poor performance in this country is to turn on the government. You didn't do this, that, and the other. And I am not here to defend the government. I do think that the government lets us down all over the place. But I find it a strange mentality to go after the government. It's as if the government is where it all starts. But that's never been true. The government's resources come from the business community and from the public. Take a look at who funds every campaign. Take a look at who funds every candidate for office. Take a look at who maintains armies of lobbyists to shape the laws that come out of City Hall, the governor's mansion, the state legislature, or Washington. We don't have a government that is independent. The government is dependent. And as any honest politician will tell you, the dependence is on those who are the richest, the corporate businesses, the big businesses of this country, and the people they make wealthy by having them be highly paid executives. It's them who make the government have no money, so it can't do things. When people say, well, the government doesn't have the money to do that, well, the question is, well, why not? It's no scarcity of money. I'm a professor of economics. I can assure you that the money is there. That's why we bail out the banks. Suddenly, the banks fall apart, and guess what? Republicans and Democrats fall all over themselves to provide the bailout, to provide the money. No one in the crash of 2008 or 9 hesitated in Congress in those last 4 months of 2008 and into 2009. They gave tax cuts to the corporations. They gave bailouts. They did everything that was necessary. And when occasionally a politician said, gee, where's this money going to come from? They all made fun of it. If we can't raise it in taxes, we'll borrow it. Well, let me be an economist again and remind everyone. If you don't tax corporations and the rich in America, but you want to take care of people, then you have to borrow the money. That's what the word deficit means. The government is spending more than it borrows. But from whom does the government borrow? Answer, from corporations and the rich. You know how you know that? Well, count the number of times you've had a government officer come to your home to discuss with you how much you're going to lend to Washington. That's never happened because you're not in that game. You're not relevant. It's the corporations and the rich who lend to the government. And now follow me, because if you get this, you'll understand high finance. Corporations and the rich say to the government, you must not tax us, you must not tax us, you must not tax us. But the government says, well, then I can't do anything. Oh, you must take care of people at least a little, otherwise we'll have a revolution. I have the solution. We will lend you, we, the corporations and the rich, we will lend you the money that we're not paying you in taxes. Now, point be for a moment with me, a corporation or the rich. Which would you rather do? Have the government come, take the taxes, end of story, or not take the taxes, but instead you lend that money to the government, it pays you interest for a few years, and then gives you the money back. Of course, big business doesn't want to pay taxes and then lends the money to the government. They've been doing that for decades. But the joke is on the people, because we end up having to pay the extra taxes to pay them back and to pay interest for the loans. Would have been much better for us to tax them in the first place, which is why they prevent it. So don't do this to one another. The government is to blame. The government is shaped in all of its crucial functions by a very small minority, the employers and the people they make wealthy who run this economic system. That's where the problem lies. And on that level, yeah, you're right, Esty. It doesn't matter all that much, Republican or Democrat. For lots of other issues, it does. And most Americans vote on those other issues, whether it's for or against abortion, or for or against foreign wars, or for and against civil liberties. Those are very important issues, and they differ on that. But on the basic question of capitalism, we haven't had an honest debate between Republicans and Democrats about capitalism in my lifetime. And I was born a long time ago in Youngstown, Ohio. I've lived and worked in America all my life, as I do to this day. Republicans and Democrats do not dare talk about capitalism and socialism and all of that, except to dismiss it or denounce it. They are unwilling to have an honest human conversation. Let's see the strengths and weaknesses of capitalism. Let's look at them. And now let's look at the strengths and weaknesses of another system. We don't do that in America. Instead, we do something that ought to make us ashamed. We go rah-rah for our side and poo-poo for the other side. And you know, you're supposed to outgrow that, I don't know, when you're maybe 6 or 7, it should lose its attractiveness and you should kind of grow up. Well, in this country, we're still working on that growing up on the subject of capitalism and socialism.
Well, my guest is Professor Richard Wolff. We are talking about his latest book, The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. I want to thank Jackie Austin, who pledged online, and she likes A Public Affair and Letters on Politics, and she says, I appreciate Wolff's existence, but she is the only pledge that I have received since the last time, so I am going to have to pledge wrap, unfortunately. I would so much prefer to listen to Richard Wolff. I have 2 pages full of questions. Obviously, we won't get to even a quarter of it, but I would like to get to as much as possible. I need to see this door open with pledges given to us, or I need to hear from Richelle or Summer that other people have pledged online. Let me take that opportunity to let you know who won last week's book. And that is Jim from Loganville. Thank you so much, Jim, and to everybody who pledged last week. We made our goal, but it kind of happened in the last 5-10 minutes, and I would rather avoid doing that again this week. So, if you appreciate all the shows that I've been doing on Fridays since the last pledge drive, the time to pledge is now, or to pay, or to become a monthly donor, or to increase your monthly donation. Again, we do have to use still the tools of capitalism, like, monthly donation, where we draw your money straight from the bank. But we are looking for a better system, and we are busy every week here exposing some terrible face of capitalism, including the climate emergency that we are in. You might remember I started talking about climate change in 1996. Very few people talked about it then, mostly scientists. I don't know that anyone, or well, probably some people in the media did, but that's been what I've been trying to do, is point out very destructive things and come up with solutions. And I do it with incredible guests every week. I think I feel very good about being here for the 26th year, not getting a penny. Richard, for 26 years I've been doing this, and it's a volunteer gig. And you know, it takes a lot of preparation. I actually read and check on the people and come up with what I hope are good questions. Because I feel it's very important to, in other ways, not participate in the capitalist system, not expect to get paid and to make profit on everything that you do. And I'm sure you are doing that too. So we need to hear from our listeners. We need to get a bunch of pledges. I am going to get back to Richard. I'm going to trust you to have called us, 608-256-2001, extension 1. I hope that the door will open here quickly, and we will get our phone answerers to give me your pledges, and let me thank them. They are today Patricia, Lois, and Lucinda. Thank you so very much, the three of you, for supporting us that way, and I need the rest of you to support us the other way, through money, because it does take money to run a station like that. Richard, anything you want to say in help, in support of what I've been blabbering here?
Yes, because one of the most important problems in the United States has to do with media. And we allow, in a way most other countries do not, the overwhelming dominant media to be privately owned by capitalist corporations who openly say that their number one objective is profit. That's their goal. That's why they're in business. Profit is our bottom line. We have many ways of saying it in our culture. Corporate executives who can get higher profits have a secure position. Corporation executives who don't have a very insecure position. So if you're a corporate executive and you're running CNN or CBS or ABC or any of the others, including Fox News, you better show a profit or they're going to show you the door. You're not there for any other purpose. That's your function. That's why you were hired, and that's why you will continue to work there. And that means that they may carry a variety of points of view, but a criticism of the system of capitalism, we can't really expect that from large capitalist corporations who only got big enough to be a media giant because they have played the capitalist game throughout their lives. Therefore, stations like WORT and so on have to be given the support. Otherwise, there's no alternative point of view out there. I reported earlier today, because I have a program too, on a poll done in Great Britain by something called the Institute for Economic Affairs. It's a right-wing think tank. And they did a survey February and March of this year, 2,000 randomly selected citizens in the United Kingdom. 72% of them said that they believe that the climate change crisis in Britain is the fault of the capitalist system. Now, England has a conservative government, more conservative than Mr. Biden. Boris Johnson is as close to being a Trump clone as Mr. Bolsonaro is in Brazil. And yet, despite being in power for many years, 72% of a random selection of the British citizenship said that they blame capitalism for the climate crisis. By the way, 67%, almost as much, said they would prefer to live in a socialist Britain than a capitalist one. This right-wing think tank that commissioned the poll is extremely upset with this result. They didn't want it. They didn't expect it. And they're trying to figure out what is going on. And they're going to improve their message. I have news for them, which I will share with you. This is not about a message. This is the British people living through these crashes, living through the pandemic, and living through the disastrous decision they made back in 2016 to blame Europe for their problems. It's a little bit like the United States blaming Haitian and other immigrants from Central America as if they were the cause of the economic difficulties of this country. So no, I urge you all to contribute to WORT and to any and all independent alternative media. It is a service, a patriotic service, to raise the level of understanding, debate, and discussion without which a democracy becomes a hollow caricature of itself.
Agreed. And, okay. Agreed. I don't. What's going on here? We're having an echo issue. Let me try again. Can you hear me now? Okay. All right. I guess, I don't know. Technology. Thank you, Richard. I agree with you. We did get another pledge from Melanie online. Thank you so much, Melanie. We are now at about a quarter of our goal. So what are we gonna do? I mean, I really don't want to spend the last 19 minutes pledge wrapping. I know that you appreciate hearing Richard. I want to hear Richard. As I said, you know, we won't get to to even a quarter of what I wanted to talk about, but we need to hear from you. 608-256-2001 extension 1 or wortfm.org. So I'm going to ask Richard another question, and then if I don't get, I mean, you can see that his answers are very very full, very comprehensive. If I don't hear from you all, we're going to have to let Richard go, which would be, in my opinion, just tragic. I just want to, we got another one from Anonymous. Thank you. And that gets us yet farther, but we are not there yet. So, I mean, we're not at the half yet, actually. So we need to hear from many more of you. And just before I ask you the next question, Richard, I want to tell you that by chance, since I'm doing kind of a deep clean of my house and getting rid of, you know, my clutter, we all have this problem, I found these poems of Bertolt Brecht yesterday that were, you know, I just put it somewhere because I like them, and so I got to read them again yesterday, and I was so taken by how sharp he is in making these points. So, for example, these were all poems about war, and so how when the leaders say, no, we're not thinking about war, you know that war is coming, and when they say it is necessary, you know that it's all about them making money. And, you know, then people die who are not the people who are starting the war for profit. And, I mean, I can't really, I wish I brought them, though they were translated to Hebrew, which is my first language, and it was a very good translation. But I wish I could express myself half as good as he does. But I don't know, maybe we should talk about that also, about war and its role in the capitalist system, and Bertolt Brecht if you'd like. But folks, I need you to pledge. Hey, like right now, I need to see some money. Go ahead, Richard. I'm getting angry, but well, you know.
Yeah, no, that's good. The passion is what we need.
Yes.
And Bertolt Brecht was a very passionate German poet, probably the greatest poet they had in the 20th century, certainly the greatest playwright that they had in the 20th century.
Yes.
And he comes out of the German war experience. He was a young man, just beginning in World War I, one of the most destructive wars of human beings in the history of war, World War I, devastated Germany. He became known as an artist in the aftermath of World War I, when literally one out of every three German men had a wound of some kind, missing an arm, missing a leg. I mean, these are the ones who survived. Millions were killed. But it was a country in which war was the enemy and war was the horror. And much of Bertolt Brecht's writings is a study of war and the impact it has on people. If you read Mother Courage, or you read The Threepenny Opera, or you read any of his great poetry, his writings, it's an extraordinary critique of a system. By the way, Capitalism was the name of the system. Every one of the countries that declared war on one another in 1914 was a capitalist economic unit. Germany, Britain, France, Russia at the time. When Russia goes into the war in 1914, it's a capitalist society. I mention that because people sometimes, in a very bizarre, even macabre way, are critical of communism or socialism because people died in the Soviet Union and China as they made their revolutions and in the aftermath. And that is a tragedy, and that is to be questioned for sure. But if you want to count dead people as a measure of a society, be very careful, because by that count, capitalism in its two world wars and its 400 years of colonialism, it has a clear winner on that score, if the word winner is correct. But let's turn to war itself. Mr. Biden just removed the United States' last troops from Afghanistan. I want to look at Afghanistan with you as an economist. And here I'm relying on statistics prepared by the Watson Institute at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. Brown University, an Ivy League school, maintains the Watson Institute to measure the economic costs of American warfare abroad. So we have a university level study in the United States by Americans of the cost of the war. And by the way, they do this for the Iraq War. They do this for all of them. They measure, and no one has really challenged this, that the cost of the war in Afghanistan over the 20 years that it was fought was somewhere between $1 and $1.5 trillion. Okay, who won the war? Well, the American people, by no stretch of the imagination, won anything. The last troops are gone from that country, U.S. troops. The ostensible enemy, the so-called Taliban, is now the government in Kabul. The Taliban took possession of billions of dollars of American equipment that was left there. And thousands of Americans were killed there in combat. More thousands committed suicide after they came home to the United States. Tens of thousands were wounded physically, mentally, or both. And just multiply those numbers by 10 or 20, and then you have the dead and the wounded of the Afghani people. None of those people won anything. So the Taliban won the war. The Afghanistan people lost a lot. The war was a war between one of the richest countries in the world, the United States, and one of the poorest countries on this planet, Afghanistan. For those of you that know something about the Bible, you might begin to think about David and Goliath, but don't think too long, because it's obvious which of the two countries was David and which of the two countries was Goliath. Did any Americans win? And the answer is absolutely. Here's who won. It's called the military-industrial complex. It's the six major defense producers. I have to stop and always remind everyone, here in the United States, everything the military does is called defense. In other countries, the same department that we call defense is called, for example, the War Department. It's much more honest. We are defending. We are the only country in the world which currently maintains 70 to a, between 70 and 500, depending on how you count. Some of them are secret bases in foreign countries. No other country does this, but we are defending, aren't we? The People's Republic of China, the number one enemy we have today, has no troops in any other country. The United States has huge numbers of troops in many, many, many countries. There is no contest, but the big corporations, oh, they did well. All those drones that kill people, you know, like that family the last couple of weeks ago.
Yep.
Those are very expensive, those drones, those bombs, those missiles, those tanks, those planes, the United States corporations that make all those things, sell them to the government. That's where the bulk of the money for war goes. It doesn't go. It stays right here. It goes from Washington, D.C. into the bank accounts of the corporation. They were winners, as they always are. So we had two winners, the Taliban, which took over Afghanistan, and the American defense producers, who made trillions of dollars. And before we could forget the war in Afghanistan, they are beating the drums for the next one with China, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's the only thing that should surprise you more than any of this is the docile way the American people act as spectators for all of this, even when it costs them their money, costs them their children, costs them all the secondary effects that these horrific wars have on the people of this country, not even to speak about all those out there.
Yeah, and
but anyway,
you know,
you have some good news, maybe?
I do, but I just want to say quickly that was actually the last little poem by, is it Brecht, not Brecht?
It depends if you're German or not. If it's German, it's Bertolt Brecht.
Brecht.
You have a soft CH.
Yeah.
Brecht.
Anyway.
Just so you know, my first language is German.
Uh-huh.
My mother was born and raised in Berlin. That's the language. Before I ever learned English, I was born in the United States, but my mother was a refugee and came here.
Uh-huh. So, yeah, his first poem, which is really just like maybe three lines, is "The war is over. Who are the winners? The rich. Who are the losers? The poor, on both sides." So, yeah, I do have good news. And actually, let me start with another person who, well, no, his first language wasn't German, but he is the son of German people, and that's Willy Becker. Thank you, Willy, for pledging, and thank you, Peggy, for pledging. And I'm not going to read what all of you like, but thank you so very much. I'm trying to save time so that we can ask Richard another question before we're done here. Cindy, thank you so very much. And then online, we had another anonymous donor, Amy, Jonathan, Kathleen. Thank you all so very much. We'd love to hear from a few more of you in our last few minutes here. And Richard, there's no way you'd be able to answer it the way you answer things, but maybe just give us a taste. And if we can, you know, maybe we can have you again in a couple months or so to talk about all the other questions that we didn't get to.
I'd be glad to.
Okay, great. So just you know that what the capitalists do when things get hard for them. You actually say that capitalism is in crisis right now, which I wish we had the 20 minutes. We need to talk about that. And then you say that in situations like that, they come up with reforms. And then you have your own thoughts on how we defeat capitalism and come up with a better system. So obviously we're talking here about 60 minutes worth of talk. Which one of these would you like to answer for the last 5 minutes while people still keep pledging?
Well, you know, reform is something people do when they still believe that something basic in the system is valuable, so that we're going to try to fix what has gone on without changing the system. So in the Great Depression of the 1930s, the United States created the Social Security system. We never had that before. Unemployment compensation. We never had that before. Minimum wage. We never had that before. And government jobs for millions of people, which we had never had before. So the great reforms. But what we didn't do is take away the ownership and operation of businesses from the small handful of corporate executives that run them. So guess what? When the reforms were achieved over their opposition, when the people went to the president at that time, Franklin Roosevelt, and got these things done, well, eventually Roosevelt died, 1945. World War II, which came at the end of the Depression, was over, 1945. And the businessmen and women and the rich decided to revenge, to undo everything that was done in the 1930s, the so-called New Deal. And they did it. Over the last 40 years, the communists who were crucial in the 30s wiped out. The socialists that were crucial in the 30s wiped out. The labor movement, which was very strong in the 30s, is now a pale shadow of itself. They undid it. And my response is, I don't want to do all that again. I don't want another bevy of reforms because it's not enough. You have to make the reforms, but to make them stick, to make them permanent, to make them irreversible. The way we made slavery irreversible, we haven't slid back to slavery. We haven't slid back to feudalism with lords and serfs. We have to get beyond capitalism, and there's only one way I know how to do that, and that's to convert every business from a top-down hierarchy to a community, to a worker cooperative. That's the future if we have one.
Well, thank you, Richard. Thank you, Lois, for not just answering the phones, but also maintaining your monthly donation. So that's the one person who did that. I think we need a couple more of the people who either are new monthly donors or are upping their monthly donation. And also, if you still pledge now, I will be able to thank you during the Funny Boys show. Richard, we have a date in a couple, 3 months or so to talk about everything else. I'm going to keep, because there's so much to talk about, and we got to really just very little bit of it. But thank you so very much for joining us. Richard Wolff, Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, currently visiting professor in the graduate program International Affairs of the New School, University of New York City. One thing I'll ask you when we meet again is how does a person like you actually get to be professor emeritus and all that? But we'll talk about it next time. Thank you so much again for joining us today.
My pleasure, and my very, very best wishes for the maximum successful fundraising that you deserve and that I am happy to participate in helping you to raise.
Thank you. And thanks to Richelle and Summer, our regular team, and to our phone answerers again, Patricia, Lois, Lucinda. Thank you all so much for pledging today. I'm Esti Dinor. We'll be talking again next week, and it will not be a pledge drive. Bye-bye.